I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So at this point, I think we're going to go ahead and just bring Emmy Laiha on from the Federal Facilities Office here at EPA to do a quick reminder of the ongoing series, which is part of the Federal Facilities Academy, so our audience knows how to participate. Emmy, I can see you on camera, so let me spotlight you and turn the floor to you.
Sure. Thank you so much, Jean. So just a quick plug-in for our Federal Facilities Academy. This is one of 11 webinars that is really geared to looking at the nuances of Superfund cleanups at our federal facilities. This webinar is a little unique in that everything we cover actually applies to both private sites, which are with our PRPs, and also federal facility sites. So I'm so glad that you all have joined us today. And Jean's going to give all the details on how to get credit for completion of the academy, which is actually recognized by our director of the federal facilities program. So Jean, I'll hand it back over to you to tell them how to get that.
All right. Thank you, Emmy. So as Emmy just highlighted, there are 11 online webinars that are open to the public and one classroom delivery, which is open to a limited audience. All of the online webinars will be available for you to register and take live, and they will all be recorded and available for you to replay or watch on demand. For that in-person classroom training opportunity, that is only available to take in-person and live. And of course, as noted, that's open to a very limited audience for staff from EPA, states, tribes, and other federal agencies. Now, for each of the online courses, whether you attend live or you replay the recorded versions, you can receive a participation certificate for any of the online events that you take. And again, it doesn't matter the format. You simply either attend live or replay the recorded version and then follow the instructions at the end to give your feedback to get that participation certificate. You can document your attendance in any or all of these sessions. If you're able to do all 11 of the online courses, whether live, online, or a recorded version, or some mix and match of those options, as well as take that live in-person classroom delivery, if you combine and complete that as well, you'll be eligible to receive the Academy certificate that notes that you participated in both the online and in-person classroom opportunities. So I'll come back to this and remind everyone at the very end on how you can submit a feedback for today's session and then get your participation of your certificate of participation at the end of our session today. So Emmy, I think with those reminders, I'll go ahead and turn the floor back to you so that we can go ahead and get started with the materials. So I'm going to put your spotlight up on the floor here, and then I will turn off the screen share so that you can show the presentation content, and we'll get started with the technical materials.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jean. Are you seeing the slides?
I see those slides. They look great. Go ahead.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So let's go ahead and get started on today's webinar. This will be looking at performance measures and environmental indicators. Really quick, my name is Emmy Laiha. I am in our Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office. Other instructors will be joining me today, and they will introduce themselves once they start their section of the presentation today. So let's go ahead and jump on it. But before I start going over the slides, I would like to get a better sense of who all is participating in today's webinar. So we have a group poll where we're asking what type of performance measures are important to your agency at your federal facility site. Some people have typed in what group they're with. However, I'm interested to know where everybody is joining us from and how you measure success or what your agency really sees as its priorities when it comes to cleanup. Jean, can you tell them how they can participate in this poll?
Absolutely. So for now, we're going to ask everyone to use the Q&A to type in your response to these questions. So go ahead and look for that Q&A button at the bottom, and you can begin typing your response in, and then either hit that submit button or hit the enter key. And again, Emmy's looking to find out what type of performance measures are important to your agency at your federal facility sites. And we do have an international audience today. I'm seeing a couple of comments from people attending globally. So we're glad to have you. And thank you for staying up, because I think there's a significant time zone difference here. Emmy, as I'm seeing some of these responses that are coming in, some attendees are responding with a lot of acronyms. So for example, GPRAs, I'm seeing SCDHEC with FFAs that we have no further actions for their sites, that we've got some state interests that need to be met and cleanup is complete. People are looking for cleanup of sites below MCLs. They are looking at environmental indicators, site-wide ready for anticipated reuse, construction complete, remedial action completion, human health and the environment. Oh, also looking at review timeframes and milestone completions from like a project management
perspective. Milestone completions, that is a big one for sure.
Oh, accuracy of estimated cost to complete, another acronym, CTC. And then here for some, we're noting some of those performance measures, again, human exposure, groundwater migration under control status, PRGs, a lot of MCLs, cleanups complete, ready for anticipated reuse, more NFAs. So we're starting to see some trends popping up in those responses.
Yes, thank you, everybody. That does help us understand a little bit where we're all coming from. In a nutshell, our agencies have different priorities. We all want to complete cleanup, but how we measure our successes can vary. So when it comes to performance measures, we're going to talk more about what priorities exist for EPA and how those are measured. So I'm going to go ahead and I'll let John introduce himself, but I'm going to hand it over to our next presenter to take us through the overview and the first section of our course.
Thanks, Emmy. I'm John Burchett from EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office here at headquarters, and I'll start us here with an overview. So in this course, we'll discuss performance measures, how those measures relate to the role of environmental indicators under CERCLA, how environmental indicators may affect other CERCLA components, and review guidance and tools that are helpful in making EI determinations. Next slide. Okay, so we'll kick things off with talking about performance measures. And the first thing we'll talk about, and I'm anxious that some of the folks responded in the chat about Government Performance and Results Act measures, are also known as GPRA. So this is a congressional action that addresses all federal agencies. The law was enacted in 1993 to promote improved government performance and greater public confidence in government. GPRA requires the federal agencies to develop results-oriented and outcome-related goals. The goals are meant to align with annual plans, budgets, and to long-term outcomes through multi-year agency-specific strategic plans. A key component of the Act is to reform government performance by setting goals, measuring performance against these goals, and reporting publicly on their progress. Three elements of the GPRA that I did want to point out are the five-year strategic plans, annual performance plans, annual reports of agency successes and failures in meeting targets. And I also wanted to point out that the GPRA was modernized in 2010 and directs EPA to consult with Congress and requires agencies to solicit and consider views of those entities potentially affected or interested in the strategic plan. And sort of the high level takeaway that I want to point out here, guys, is that historically the government hadn't done a great job with tracking and reporting progress, and the GPRA addressed that. Next slide. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about the roles of the GPRA. So the GPRA provides a general framework for government accountability through the use of the strategic plan. Under the framework, EPA develops strategic plans, annual performance goals, and other measures, and national programs develop planning and tracking mechanisms for those. Next slide. Okay, so the Superfund remedial program, which we of course are a part of, tracks six performance measures and reports three to Congress. GPRA measures are important because they are linked to budget requests to Congress. One factor in formulating budget requests is the amount of money needed to complete the anticipated work. Okay, next slide. Okay, so I mentioned the six performance measures, and here they are. So you have remedial site assessments completed. That one's pretty self-explanatory. You have human exposure under control, site-wide ready for anticipated use, remedial action project completions, migration of contaminated groundwater under control, and construction completion. And one thing I'll point out quickly for folks that are, especially the ones that are doing a lot of federal facilities work, is that the majority of these are site-wide measures. And you guys know those can be sometimes difficult for us to accomplish at the federal facility sites. But we do have those opportunities for measuring incremental progress through remedial action completions. Okay, next slide. Okay, so you might ask yourself, you guys have all these measures, where are you tracking all of this information? And so we track that in what is called the Superfund Enterprise Management Systems, or SEMS. And so it's used for planning, tracking, and maintaining records. We also use the SEMS reports to track progress on the strategic planning goals. So EPA and EPA headquarters in the regions will check in on these targets with the regions through work planning and through various other outreach efforts. For each one of the measures that we talked about in the previous slide, we do have subject matter experts. Sometimes we call them data sponsors that are very keened in with the regions and work closely with them on the status of those targets. Okay, next slide. Okay. What you're seeing on the screen here is the human exposure dashboard. This is something we're really excited about. It was something we developed and launched in January of 2018 to improve the public access to human exposure data and information. The dashboard provides live SEMS data on the human exposure status for Superfund sites and Superfund alternative approach sites. The dashboard, as you can see, includes a national overview of the status counts, which are viewable in the chart form or in the data tables. Next slide. And you also see you have access to these filter panes, which allows the users to select options to filter the data down. You can select the exposure status, the federal facility status, or the region if you are just interested in specific information. Okay, and the last slide, this is one really cool feature among many of the application, is that you can find the detailed exposure pathway descriptions for all of the human exposure insufficient data in not controlled sites by clicking the exposure status link. And this information comes directly from our EPA RPMs in the regions that work closely with their teams to update this information annually. Okay, and with that, I will kick it over to Boone O'Neill to give us some more in-depth information on environmental indicators.
Thank you, John. I hope everyone's doing well today. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Boone O'Neill. I work in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, otherwise known as OSREDI. John's done a good job of taking us through all of the overview of our performance measures. So I'm going to talk specifically about the human exposure environmental indicator. My role is to coordinate on both environmental indicators, which include human exposure and groundwater migration. And this includes private and federal sites. John mentioned that we sometimes call that role a data sponsor. So my job is to work with all of the regions, the 10 EPA regions, to make sure that we have a consistent approach to performing these evaluations. So just a couple quick caveats about the measure. So the measure is designed to categorize our incremental progress in protecting human exposure. And this is all in the attached notes for additional information, what's not listed on the slides. Also about this measure, these apply to current and final and deleted MPL sites and Superfund Alternative Agreement sites, otherwise known as SAA. They apply site-wide. So even one small exposure pathway can cause an entire site to change status. And they also apply to current conditions rather than future conditions. And that's important because it allows us to measure that incremental progress, right? So those are just a few caveats. We see here on the screen our five different statuses for the human exposure measure. The first one obviously is insufficient data, and this is exactly what it sounds like, and we'll go through each of these statuses in the coming slides. Then there's under control and not under control, which should be self-explanatory. And then we have two elevated versions of under control. Those are HEPR and HHPA. These we'll discuss more on some following slides, but what's important to know here is that these are rolled up and publicly reported as HUC, and the designations HEPR and HHPA are used as internal tracking metrics, and they're not reported publicly. Next slide, please. So the first status we'll go through, insufficient data. Obviously, this is where sites don't have enough information to decide whether or not they're under control. Typically, these are happening at newly listed sites where we haven't gathered all that information, but it also frequently happens to sites where we have new information that calls into question the previous evaluation, and thus, in some cases, causing a site to retract from HUC back to HEID for us to gather that additional information that may impact the site-wide status. And it's important to note here, if you're one of the EPA employees, that when we're planning and putting this information into SIMS, as John previously was mentioning SIMS, it's important to tie a planning date to when we expect to have sufficient data, because that allows us to kind of project when we might be able to bring sites under control. Next slide, please, Amy. So the next status, HUC, oftentimes I think it's a bit confusing for some people that this is both a performance measure in and of itself and one of the five human exposure statuses. So basically, when we bring a site to that under control milestone, that counts as an accomplishment for the performance measure, but it's also a status designation itself. And HUC happens when we control human exposure, obviously, and cut off, we mitigate exposures, or we cut off those pathways to human exposures. And it's important to note here that just because a site is HUC doesn't necessarily mean that it's construction complete yet, or that we've achieved all of our long-term cleanup goals. As I mentioned, there's those two higher level statuses that that can categorize those milestones, but under control means under control. And there are basically five different ways that we can five different ways we can bring a site under control. The first is collecting sufficient data to say that there are no exposure pathways and thus validate that the site is protective with evidence. The next way is by reducing contamination below risk-based levels. The third is eliminating those exposure pathways themselves. And then we have, prevention of human exposure. So making sure that human exposure receptors don't contact the contamination that's left in place on the site. And then the last way that we can bring a site under control is influencing harmful human health activity. And so this is kind of making sure that we have ICs in place to prevent trespassers from reaching the contamination, or at least reducing the trespassing to a level where it's not necessarily enough to bring a site all the way to not under control. Next slide, please. So we're going to turn to Jean to do this poll. We have a quiz question based off of what we've learned so far. So Jean, take it away.
All right, thank you, Boone. So there is a scenario proposed on slide 17. In this scenario, soil and groundwater samples have been collected at Superfund Site X, which is part of a remedial investigation. The baseline human health risk assessment has been completed, and there are currently no unacceptable human exposure pathways. So I'm about to pop up a poll window right now on the screen. which will ask you to identify what is your initial human exposure status determination. You should see options A through E with a circle next to each one. Simply click the circle next to the option that you think is the correct response, and then hit the submit button when you are done. Now, not everyone else can see this, but I can see through the power of Zoom as these responses are starting to come in. It looks like about a quarter of the audience has shared their responses, but I am waiting for additional people to continue to submit those answers. Remember, there is no penalty if you get it wrong. We're just here to double check and give you an opportunity to demonstrate or apply your knowledge, and then talk about any mistakes or misunderstandings that you might have. So if you have clarification on your response, which I know some people do when they pick their answer and they want to say why they picked it, you can feel free to start chatting that in or putting that in as a response part of the Q&A as well. So if you've submitted your vote, but you want to explain why, you can always send us in clarifying responses in the Q&A as well. So right now we're looking at about 65% of you having cast your vote, and I'm going to count to three and then close her down and talk about how you voted. Remember, it's either A, current human exposure not under control, B, insufficient data to determine human exposure, control status, C, current human exposure under control, D, current human exposure under control and protective remedy or remedies in place, or E, current human exposure under control and long-term human health protection achieved. So 1, 2, 3, I'll go ahead and hit that end button and I'll share the distribution of results. So it looks like about 2/3 of you thought the correct answer was C, current human exposure under control, but a number of you felt that B, insufficient data to determine human exposure control status, was the correct answer. Boone, what is the response expected for this one?
All right. So I am not surprised by the range of answers. The answer that we were leaning towards here in this scenario was HUC, and that's because the description says that the baseline human health risk assessment has been completed. That's the primary source of information that we look for when doing these human exposure evaluations. So it says it's been completed and that it has not found any unacceptable human exposure pathways. And so that meets the definition for HUC. I know that a number of people provided other answers, and there are, of course, other situations where this kind of simplistic model here, may have some more nuance that means that you need to collect additional information. And on a site-by-site basis, that is perfectly acceptable. There is no one exact approach to doing these evaluations because the site situations are so different. But the situation here, I do think, lends itself towards HUC. So thank you all for completing that. And if there's any questions, if anyone has any site-specific questions, feel free to email me separately. We're going to, I think, avoid those kind of site-specific what-if scenarios here. But I'm happy to see that most people were thinking along the correct answer. So we have a second one. So in this situation, there's more recent data that suggests that vapor intrusion may be occurring on site into buildings where there may be homeowners or businesses. But it's unclear if the contaminant concentrations will result in unacceptable human exposures. Remember, getting back to that risk-based scenario. So in this situation, there's not yet been data on those concentrations for vapor intrusion. And I'll note that this could have previously been a site that's under control. But what is the appropriate status given this scenario?
All right, this information. We've got another pop-up, this time looking for your updated human exposure status determination. Again, you have options A through E on the screen. You can click the circle to the left. Option A is current human exposure not under control. B is insufficient data to determine human exposure control status. C is current human exposure under control. D, current human exposure under control and protective remedy or remedies in place. And then E, current human exposure under control and long-term human health protection achieved. So you'll click the circle and then hit the submit button. So about half of you have voted. So it looks like we're getting a hang of how these questions are being posed. So I'm glad to see that. If you are sharing the line with multiple people, talk it out amongst yourself and land on an answer. And as Boone said, you can always share clarifying questions or thoughts on how you're responding or why you're responding in the Q&A. We'll be happy to talk about those. looks like about two-thirds of you have cast your votes and most answers are starting to slow down, but I'm going to count to the number three here and then close it and talk about it. So 3, 2, 1, and I'm going to end that poll and share those results. So it looks like by far, about almost 90% of the audience picked B, but a number of you felt that A could be correct. Boone, how would you expect the answer to float out for this one?
This is also, I think, what I was expecting to see. The scenario that we've laid out here, what we were trying to get at is a status of insufficient data. So again, this could have been a site that previously is under control. The scenario here says that there's new evidence, but that evidence, there's an unknown, which is the concentration. And so given that we don't know the concentration, it may be that it's not high enough to meet our risk-based criteria for not under control. We didn't necessarily say that explicitly in the situation. So again, there may be some site situations where it's abundantly clear, even before you have all of the data, that it could be not under control, and that will have to be a decision that's made on a site-by-site basis, and that's up to the regions. But this situation, I think, is often associated with an evaluation of HEID, and this is a very common, if not the most common, reason right now we see a lot of sites that have already been investigated and evaluated for human exposure might retract back to HEID. This is a very common situation. So 88% of you, looks like, chose HEID. Thank you. That's the answer we were looking for. Though the people that answered not under control, again, could be correct evaluation in some situations. Next slide, please. So the next status that we haven't talked about yet is the status of not under control. And so this is where we have risk-based evidence that suggests that there is an unacceptable exposure pathway. That exposure pathway could either already have been completed, meaning that we know people are actively being exposed to unsafe levels of contamination, or it could be a situation where we reasonably anticipate that the exposure pathway will be completed. And so for the purposes of risk communication, we would want to go ahead and put those sites, label those sites as HENC, to be responsive to our commitment to the public to inform them of any kind of risks that they may pose or that they may face. So again, this is a site-wide status. So even one single pathway at one OU at a site with many OUs, if there's a situation where there's a unacceptable exposure pathway, we would need to change that site to not under control. And just like with the HEID sites, because the descriptions of these exposure scenarios go on that human exposure dashboard that John was showing earlier, it is important to tie the dates that we expect to bring these sites under control to an action that we may take as EPA that we anticipate will bring the site under control. So that could be the completion of a remedial action. In the case of HEID, it could be the completion of a risk assessment that would give us that information to say under control or not under control. So again, it's important to make sure that we plan our projected dates according with site information that we have as RPMs and EPA staff. So in these situations, again, there's unsafe contamination somewhere on the site. It hasn't been fully mitigated or treated. And there are actual or reasonably anticipated exposures occurring on the site. Next slide, please. And we got one more, apply your understanding here. So this is also a common situation that we see. In this situation, it was determined that there are unsafe levels of contaminated groundwater in drinking water, but EPA has provided the local population with drinking bottled water, and the groundwater remedy has not yet been selected or implemented. So in this situation, what is the human exposure status?
All right, so I'm going to launch that poll. And again, you'll see another pop-up on the screen with options A through E. If you happen to be participating using a mobile device or don't see the pop-up, look for three dots or a more menu at the bottom of your screen, and that should pop up a whole slew of other tools, and you may find the section for polls if it's not loading as a separate window. So again, option A would be current human exposure not under control. Option B is insufficient data to determine human exposure control status. Option C is current human exposure under control. D is current human exposure under control and protective remedy or remedies in place. And then E is also still current human exposure under control and long-term human health protection achieved. Now, in this case, we've got about half of you having sent in your response. And for those of you who can't see things, I don't control where the poll window shows up on your screen. So it's a separate floating window and you can move it around and resize it and put it anywhere that you like. So for anyone who's chatting in and asking me to move the poll window, you actually can click on the title of the poll window and drag it around or put your cursor on the outer edge and resize the poll window as needed. And now it looks like about 2/3 of you have gotten those responses in. But interestingly, Boone, this one seems to be causing some debate amongst our attendees because I'm seeing a variation in responses here. We seem to be centering around a common answer, but there's definitely some variations here. So I'll give you all just a few more seconds to consider before sending those votes in. Remember, click the circle and then hit the submit button. And I'm going to count down here before we close it out. 3, 2, 1. And I do have some responses here coming in with in the Q&A regarding why people are voting, how they're voting. We see a distribution here. It looks like about half of them picked A, but almost a third picked C, 20% picked D, and some people felt more comfortable with B. So I think A is the winner, but there definitely is a distribution here. Mm-hmm. And we did have someone who just chatted in that they picked A specifically because bottled water did not eliminate exposure through water vapor from showering, dishes, laundry, et cetera. So they just wanted to add that clarification.
That is a good clarification. I'm glad for whoever put that in the chat. I see that we're looking into all of the extra information that's left out of the basic description here. I will say that D is definitely not the correct answer, because in this situation, the description says that the groundwater remedy has not been selected. And so the bottled water is not the remedy necessary, is not the groundwater remedy that is needed. So that would be leaning towards HEPR. I don't think in any situation that would be the correct answer. But I was expecting to see a split between under control and not under control. That's very good. And that was actually intentional, because this example is meant to illustrate that this can be a situation and often is a situation where EPA is able to bring a site to under control. And that's the correct answer that we were looking for. So in this basic situation, we have cut off the exposure pathway by providing bottled water. Now, again, that's a basic situation. And though we were looking for an answer of under control, there definitely are situations where this would still be a site that's called not under control, because we don't know about necessarily the effectiveness of the bottled water being used. Like the person in the chat said that the contaminated groundwater could still be used for showering and dishes. That's very true. So there are situations where just because we provided the bottled water doesn't mean that everyone is necessarily cut off from the exposure pathway. So there definitely are situations where this is not the quick fix it's intended to be. So I think both answers could apply here. We were trying to illustrate this as an example for how to bring us a basic way to bring a site under control by cutting off that exposure pathway and then dealing with the mitigating the exposure in the groundwater at a later date. So I really appreciate the range of answers there. That's exactly what we are looking for. Thank you, Gene. And next slide, please. So that example was kind of building towards these other higher level under control statuses that we previously mentioned. Quick note off the top, these two statuses are the human exposure statuses that are required for a site to go to to be considered SWARU. So that will the site-wide ready for anticipated use. Colleague Alexis will discuss that towards the end of this presentation that distinct performance measure, but that performance measure does need a human exposure status of HEPR or HHPA to have that SWARO eligibility. So first, the situation of HEPR. This is a situation where it's under control, but also there's three other conditions that have been met. The first is that the site is construction complete or CC. The next is that all of the institutional controls and the engineering controls are in place and operating as intended. And also that the that those remedies are functioning as intended. So it's important that all three conditions are met to bring a site from basic HEUC to the elevated HEPR. Next slide, please. This last status, HHPA, it builds upon HEPR, and that we have the site's construction complete, all the institutional controls and engineering controls are in place, and they're all operating as intended. So we got all three of those criteria met, but also on top of that, EPA has met all cleanup goals related to human exposure as outlined in the ROD for the site. And so this is a situation where we do need to take into account future use and reasonably anticipated future use, whereas the other statuses focus on the current situation. This is basically the ultimate milestone that we're trying to get a site to. This is kind of the long-term, and it's in the acronym, the long-term human health protection achieved. So this is typically for sites that are deleted, where there's just O&M going on, or sites where there's been an FCOR, a final closeout report. So that that concludes our five statuses, and we will have one more slide where we kind of illustrate a situation using all three of those under control statuses here. So back to that bottled water situation. And again, this is a basic model to illustrate the distinctions in these three under control statuses. Let's say there's a situation where there's contaminated groundwater. And maybe for simplicity of this example, the only exposure pathway is through drinking water. So in the situation where we provide bottled water, we bring that site under control because we cut off the exposure pathway. Once we construct a drinking water filtration system, the site is construction complete, that's the remedy that was chosen for the groundwater mitigation, and we've decided that we've confirmed that that remedy is operating as intended, then we could bring the site to HEPR. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we have actually restored groundwater to the level that is needed as outlined in the ROD. And once the remedy has been in place long enough to reduce contamination to the appropriate concentration that is no longer posing an unacceptable exposure situation, then the site could be moved to HHPA. So those are the three situations that kind of show the progression, that incremental human health protection that we mentioned at the top of this portion of the slides. So this is, again, a basic example. There's all kinds of what-if situations, but we just wanted to provide this as a distinction because there's also often some confusion around these three statuses and how they're all distinct. So hopefully that's clear to everybody. Next slide, please. We have actually just published an update to the environmental indicator guidance, and we have a couple screenshots here from that guidance that could be additional sources of information for you to look at. We have the human exposure decision tree here. It's the worksheet that those of us that work in Superfund are familiar with in SIMS, but it's basically a logical model for how to answer these questions. And the combination of yes or no answers to those questions will result in a site-wide status. Emmy is going to walk us through each of these steps here to illustrate them in more detail, but we wanted to point it out that it's a resource that's publicly available to everyone. I think we left a link to that guidance in the presentation notes. Next slide, please. And also in that guidance, we have a updated list of appropriate documentation. Because as we answer each of these questions in SIMS, as we're thinking through that decision tree, we need to make sure that we document our decision and justify it with one of these reports. This is not necessarily an exhaustive list of documents that might be useful, but it is intended to show that there are many different sources of information that could be helpful for answering each of the questions in the human exposure decision tree. So please take a look at that resource, and I will hand it over to Emmy to discuss these decision trees and also the groundwater migration measure.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Boone. All right. So the flow chart that we showed previously, we realize that's hard to read, but it is available in the guidance, as Boone mentioned. And we're actually so excited. That is basically fresh off the press, the presses. Is that what we're saying now? And it is available online. Check out those links in your participant manual. But let's talk a little bit about how that decision tree works. So when you're looking at human exposures, I'll turn on my laser pointer here. The first question you're asking, well, do we even have enough information to make this determination? If you know, if it's very clear that no, you absolutely don't have enough information, okay, then that insufficient data to determine human exposure status is perfect. That makes perfect sense. However, say your baseline risk assessment is complete and you have other studies that support being able to make that determination. So you would go on to step two, and where you look at, well, have all the long-term human exposure related cleanup goals been met for the entire site? Boone mentioned this, but I'll just highlight it again. At our federal facility sites, we have numerous operable units with dozens, if not hundreds of waste sites located within them. So when you're looking at a site-wide measure or status, like in this case, you're looking at the whole site. So you look at that and say, oh, have we met all our cleanup goals? If the answer is yes, all your remedies are in place and you've achieved all restoration cleanup goals, then you can choose that HHPA, the current human exposures under control and long-term protection achieved. I mean, that's where we all want to get eventually, but realize, especially at our very large, complex mega sites, it's going to take a while. Say your answer is no to step two. You will continue down to step three and ask yourself, are there complete human exposure pathways between contaminated groundwater, soil, surface water, or air, and human receptors such that human exposures can be reasonably expected? Again, this is based on the current situation at the site, not any anticipated use that might happen in the future. You're looking at the current situation. So if your answer is no, there aren't any complete exposure pathways, you'll go to step five. However, if your answer is yes, then you go to step four. So let's say the answer is yes, there are complete exposure pathways. So then we would come here to step four. And the next step would be to ask yourself, are there actual or reasonably anticipated human exposures associated with those complete pathways that you identified? And are they within acceptable limits of concentration of those contaminants or not? So if they are not within acceptable limits, meaning they present an unacceptable risk, you're going to say no, which will lead to a status of human exposure not under control, because they can be exposed to contaminants at a concentration that pose an unacceptable risk to human health. However, if your answer is yes, if any exposures are happening, it is within acceptable limits under current conditions, then you'll go to step five. There you ask, is the site construction complete? Is it CC? Is the remedy operating as intended? And are any engineering and institutional controls in place and effective? Remember, Boone mentioned there were those three items that had to be met. If your answer is yes, then again, you've made it to that end point where you are current human exposures under control and those protective remedies are in place. However, if your answer is no, then you are still at human exposure under control, which is great. Just means there's more work to be done at that site. With step six, this is another piece of information to consider. Are there continuing exposures at the site? So with this step, we're really considering things like, is there a trespasser scenario happen where you've done everything you can for cleanup at the site or to have effective institutional and engineering controls, but there are continuing exposures? For this, you would only answer yes if you had done all response actions. You know, they've all been exhausted and exposures continue due to perhaps a refusal by property owners. And the EPA region is saying, look, we recognize that everything has been done at this site to try and address these exposure pathways, but be it through refusal of property owners or something similar to that situation, we're going to go ahead and classify that site as current human exposures under control. So if you have questions on that, definitely, if you're our EPA staff out in the regions and have questions, you can reach out to Boone or myself if you're not sure if that's a situation you're in. All right. So we're going to switch gears a little bit here and talk about emerging contaminants. We get many, many questions on this topic, and we have a series of scenarios and poll questions to try and help understand how EPA looks at this situation when you're trying to make an environmental indicator status determination and you have emerging contaminants that are going potentially off-site. So before we start that, I would like to get a sense of how many of you have experience with emerging contaminants at your sites. So Jean, will you take them through this quick group poll?
Sure. So there is a pop-up that should appear on the screen that'll give you the same options that you see on the slide. So it's either that the situation is unknown, as the emerging contaminant has never been included in sampling, or the emerging contaminant is in your monitoring wells, but you're not sure if it's reached surface water to drinking water. And then the third option is that the emerging contaminant is in your drinking water wells, or it's reaching the surface water, or D, that last option, none of the above. So you simply click the answer that you think applies to the following situations that you've dealt with at a site. If you've dealt with a mixture of all of these things, you can chat that into the Q&A, but pick something that is pretty prevalent or common or what you've encountered the most here, and then hit your submit button. It looks like about half of you have shared your responses. And Emmy, some of the audience have asked if we can leave the distribution of answers up a little bit longer. So I'm happy to leave that up a little bit longer for everyone, if that will be helpful. And I will remind everyone that the participant manual, which was included in the links in the chat that I sent out and is posted on that seminar homepage, it does have a great discussion on all of the resources and elements that are being presented today. So for those of you looking for more information on these options or the responses, I strongly encourage you to download that participant manual. I did include it in the meeting chat earlier, and I'll send it back out again. And I do see a number of people have chimed in and said, these have all happened to me. Every one of these.
Yes, we need to add an option for all of the above next time around. We'll do that.
All right, Emmy, so I'm going to end this poll and I'm going to share those results. It does look like we've got a nice bell curve here, and it looks like B and C have hit about a third of the audience each. But almost a quarter of them have found themselves in A, and then about 12% in D.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. That just gives us a better feeling of how effective this next little exercise we're going to do together will be. So let's go ahead and jump into it. All right. So I'm going to need you all to use your imagination a little bit here, and we're going to lay out a scenario on emerging contaminants. So imagine you have a remedial action to address soil and groundwater contamination at Superfund Site A. Isn't that a creative site name? And it has been implemented. So some of your major COCs are hexavalent chromium and TCE. Your remedy included soil removal, pump and treat of groundwater plumes that were contaminated over risk-based levels. And the last EI determination for this site was human exposures under control. However, it was recently determined that there was historical use of firefighting foam at this site. The monitoring wells were sampled for emerging contaminants, but that data hasn't come back yet. And there are no other indications that emerging contaminants have migrated to drinking water sources. Now, so for my folks who prefer a more pictorial representation, that I definitely fall into that category, here's a scenario that we're looking at. So here we have our site, Site A. You can see these circles represent our contaminant plumes, and the black circles that are filled in are monitoring wells on and around the site. These three wells over here in green represent the public drinking water supply wells. And then we have further down gradient these homes where one home has a private drinking water well. So right now we know that firefighting foam was used at the site. We're sampling, but we don't have the data yet. So considering all of that, I'd like you to ask yourselves, what human exposure or EI determination applies in this example? What would you select?
All right, so we have launched another poll. And as I said, it may be helpful to have that participant manual if you want to flip back and forth. If somebody wants to see the illustration that Emmy just had, you can put that in the Q&A. We'll be happy to move it back to that slide if someone needs that for reference. I do see about 43 or about half of you have sent your votes on in, so that's great. And we're just simply picking A. Is it keep the HEUC, the under control status, until data is collected? Is it B, you would select the HEID, or insufficient data status? Or would you select C, where you're selecting the HENC, or human exposure not under control status? And once you've picked your answer, you'll go ahead and hit that submit button. And we're at about two-thirds of you, and I'm thinking just perhaps in the interest of time, I'll do my best encouragement to say, you can do it. You don't waver, just trust your gut and go and go submit your answer. And then we'll talk about the responses. And of course, I'll keep these ones up a little bit longer as Emmy walks us through the correct one. So I'm going to count down to from 3, 2, 1. We'll go ahead and close this poll. And Emmy, it looks like about 3/4 of the audience selected B. They would select HEID as the insufficient data status. But okay, almost 1/4 of them picked A.
All right. So I know these answers are tricky because it is very site specific. And you might be saying, oh, well, what about this or what about that? In these simplified scenarios, for this one in particular, we were actually looking at keeping the status as human exposures under control, because while you're looking into the situation, you don't have data that clearly identifies there is in fact a complete exposure pathway or at what concentrations. However, I will say you could likely justify a human exposure not under control status. You could justify keeping the same status, that human exposure under control, until you have the data that clearly shows there is a complete exposure pathway to unacceptable concentrations of contaminants. You could also justify insufficient data, where you say we're pretty sure there's a complete exposure pathway based on our understanding of the site, and we're going to flip it to insufficient data. We are, at least in EPA, with the issuance of our 2022 guidance, are really trying to encourage our RPMs to have the data in hand to clearly point and justify that EI determination for your site. So in this example, we were looking for keeping it under control until that data is collected. But they're really, again, site-specific. There is really no clear right or wrong answer. There is a lot of gray when it comes to environmental indicators. Okay, let's continue. We're going to use the same scenario. So say it's a year later. We make our EI determinations on an annual basis. So there you are again, making your EI determination for this same site, site A. The sampling data that you had collected previously shows emerging contaminants are above risk screening levels in some of your monitoring wells. However, you still don't have data for the public drinking water wells or that private well, but you plan to collect that data over the next year. So same scenario in a graphic presentation. We have our site. You can see these dots in red represent monitoring wells that identified emerging contaminants in them. And we still don't know what's happening with these public drinking water wells or the private well over here. But we know that we have those concentrations above risk screening levels, RSLs, in these monitoring wells. So given that information, what status would you select?
All right. Again, we've got that floating poll window that you can move around and resize as needed. You're going to select from option A, keep the HEUC under control status until data is collected. B, select HEID, your insufficient data option. Or C, select HENC, where human exposure is not under control. You can, of course, always share your thoughts in the Q&A if you'd like as we're collecting these responses. And it looks like about half of you have sent your responses on in. If for any reason the poll windows are not loading or it's just too hard for you to send it in, you can also type it into the Q&A as well. We're just looking to give you that opportunity to apply your knowledge here. So as I'm looking and starting to see these responses are slowing down, we're almost to 60% of you having cast your votes. I think perhaps, Emmy, in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and close her out and talk through this one.
Okay.
All right. So let's share those results. And it looks like about 58% picked B, about a quarter of you picked C, but then almost 20% of you picked A. So, Emmy, what's the answer?
All right. So the answer we were looking for in this scenario was HEID, insufficient data, because, it seems that this would be an appropriate status to select since there is some data from the monitoring wells that there is an emerging contaminant on site, but we don't really know if there is that exposure pathway happening with the drinking water wells off site. Again, though, there's a lot of gray. If you wanted to argue that the status is not under control, you could likely do that. I would say in this simplified scenario, it may be a little too early to select that option until you have that definitive data showing there is a complete human exposure pathway at concentrations that pose an unacceptable risk. However, it really comes down to, can you justify and support with data the determination you're trying to make? So for our example here, we were looking for insufficient data. But you might say, hey, Emmy, you just said that based on a similar situation, you could keep it under control until you have data that shows there's a problem. So again, it really comes down to what is your justification? Are you in your gut? I tend to go with a gut feeling. Could people be exposed right now? Because all in all, these environmental indicators are intended to report back to the public if there's a risk for human exposure, if they are at risk to being exposed to contamination from the site. So if you keep that in mind, I think it really helps guide the appropriate determination to make. All right, let's continue on. Thank you for participating in that. But we are now another year later in our scenario. We're making our annual EI determination. The sampling data shows that emerging contaminants are above the RSLs in some of the public drinking water supply wells. No sampling to date has been collected from the private well. Let's say that property owner is like, no. Don't come near me or my well. I don't want you on my property. Okay, so we don't have that data point. But it seems like there is likely an unacceptable risk for human exposures based on the contaminants present in those water supply wells, drinking water supply wells. So let's look at the scenario in a picture. We're working with this new information where we have drinking water wells with emerging contaminants that are above their risk screening levels in two out of the three. Still don't know what's going on over here in this residential home. We haven't gotten access to take that sample yet. So given this situation, again, what EI determination would you say applies in this example?
All right, Emmy, I think they've got the hang of it. That box has popped open again. Again, you're gonna pick from those same three options. You're going to keep the HEUC, select HEID, or select HENC. So is it A, B, or C? And as I'm looking through, almost 40% of you have sent your votes in. And remember, the more of you that participate, the more fun this will become. So I think we do have some participants just noting in some considerations here into the Q&A, which I'll read out to you here, Emmy, in just a moment, so we can start to see their thought process. I think some people are a little bit torn, or they're wishing they had some more information.
Always wishing. We always wish we had more information. So I know that it's hard to to cram it into this simple example.
Yeah. All right. I'm starting to see the response rate slow down. Just over half of you have participated. So I'm going to go ahead and count down. 3, 2, 1. We'll close this one down and share those results. So it looked like the overwhelming majority picked C. They're going to select HENC. And one of the attendees wanted to know if, is there a public drinking water well that's being treated in a way that effectively eliminates PFAS? And if not, if that's not happening, then they would pick HENC.
Okay. In this example, we assumed there was no treatment going on at the wells. But that's a good thing to ask what's happening at those locations. So for this example, we were leaning towards selecting a status of human exposure not under control. Given that there's emerging contaminants in the public drinking water wells, there's a complete pathway. We know that those concentrations are above risk-based screening levels. So in this case, we would argue that EI status should be not under control. Again, I know some of you are going to come at me like, well, what about this and what about that? It could still be, you know, insufficient data or what have you. And we realize that. That's why the justification is so important, looking at the current conditions at the site. But hopefully this helped identify how you can address emerging contaminants at your sites, particularly when they're going off the site and affecting other resources around your site. We're seeing that a lot, at least in the Federal Facilities Program. A lot of questions come up regarding that situation. So thank you for participating in our exercise. I'd love to hear in the Q&A or in your evaluation of the course, what you think of that exercise and if you have any ideas on how we can improve it. All right, we're going to switch gears now and talk about groundwater migration as an environmental indicator. So migration of contaminated groundwater under control. This is an environmental indicator. We listed it as one of our performance measures. So typically this documents whether groundwater contamination is below protective risk-based levels, or if it's not, whether the migration of that contaminated groundwater is stabilized with no unacceptable discharge to surface water, and that monitoring is ongoing to confirm the affected groundwater remains in its original area of contamination. So I know that's a lot, but we're going to break it down. And we're going to start off with a poll. So in this poll, we're going to apply your understanding at Superfund Site Z. Again, very creative name. Jean, can you take us through this poll?
Absolutely. So in this particular case, Superfund Site Z has contaminated groundwater above these acceptable risk levels. A pump and treat remedy has been selected and treatment is ongoing. The remedy has been effective to date. Institutional controls are in place and effective, and recent data confirms that no discharged impacted water bodies is occurring. So the question that's about to pop up in that poll is groundwater migration under control? So you have three choices. You can pick A, yes, B, no, or C, I need more information. As Emmy just pointed out, that's oftentimes where we sometimes land. So we'll just ask you to quickly scan through that situation at Superfund Site Z and then pick either A, yes, B, no, or C, I need more information, and hit the submit button. Almost half of you have sent your votes in, which is great to see. We'll give you just a few more seconds here to cast those votes. Hopefully we'll get around 2/3 of you having shared your responses before I close it out. And I'm going to count down now from 3, 2, 1, the end of this poll, and share the results. So again, overwhelmingly, about 3/4 of them picked A. Yes, it is under control.
Perfect. Yes, that is the answer we were looking for, saying that groundwater migration is under control in this scenario. We're assuming that the pump and treat activities are have stabilized or even shrinking the size of the plume, and that monitoring is occurring. Again, with groundwater migration under control, we're looking at whether or not that contaminated groundwater is stabilized and that it is not discharging to surface water, which is what we laid out in this example here. However, last time around, we only had yes or no as an answer. And then we added, I need more information, because perhaps you do in fact need more information before you can make this determination. So that is also acceptable. If you're like, no, I need to know exactly what the size of the plume is, how stable is it, what have you, That is also acceptable. All right, let's continue on with this discussion on groundwater migration. We have different determinations that can be made. First off, you need to make sure that your site has contaminated groundwater. If it is not a groundwater site, then you are not going to make an EI determination for it for groundwater. You also have insufficient data, like we did for human exposures, and not under control and under control. So pretty straightforward there. When it comes to groundwater migration under control, you need to have sufficient information to make that determination, meaning all your plumes have to be fully delineated so you can know how it's moving. You need to have plumes that are stabilized, meaning they're not expanding. And again, you cannot have any unacceptable groundwater discharges to surface water. When you're trying to make this evaluation for the EI at your site, you're looking site-wide again, and you're looking at distinct plumes. So based on those existing plume boundaries, they may go off-site. So just because there's a fence around a facility, that doesn't mean that's where your evaluation ends. You need to look at the full delineation of the plume. We get a lot of questions about, well, what about M&A? M&A is part of the remedy to address this plume. So it is moving somewhat, but that's part of the remedy. So if you're using M&A to verify that contaminated groundwater migration is under control, that can be acceptable. Again, it's a site-specific determination, but know that M&A can come into play. Also, be sure that you've evaluated whether there is groundwater discharge to surface water. That's going to be important. And I guess one other thing that I want to clarify is sometimes at our very large sites, we'll get an argument that, oh, well, there's no contaminated groundwater leaving the site. Like, okay, well, that's great. But do you have contaminated groundwater that is moving across your site, meaning those plumes are expanding and they're not stabilized? Even in that case, you would say that your migration of contaminated groundwater is not under control. So just because it's all on site and not leaving the site doesn't mean it's under control. I know that can be a little bit confusing, but again, what is happening with the plumes, regardless if they stay on your site boundaries or if they migrate off, is the plume stabilized? And that's what you have to keep in mind. I know you can't read this, but I just want you to know in the 2022 environmental indicator guidance that's just been released, you have this flowchart, but we're going to break it down with a more color-coded approach in the following slides. So let's go ahead and look at this together. You're going to start off with a question. Is it a groundwater site? If not, then no, you're not going to proceed, right? It doesn't need a groundwater determination. However, if it is a groundwater site, then you look at your most current data and you're going to see if of all that information, is there known and reasonably suspected releases to groundwater being considered? If you don't have enough data to make that determination, then you would say no. And that would lead you to an insufficient data determination for groundwater. However, if you say, yes, we do have enough information, you'll go down to step two and ask, is groundwater known or reasonably suspected to be contaminated above risk-based levels as a result of a release from the site? If you don't know and you need more data, again, you come to this insufficient data column. Or determination, I mean, the answer is no, well, then your contaminated groundwater migration is under control. And that's the ultimate status that we want to get to. However, if your answer is yes, you're going to come to step three and look at, is the migration of contaminated groundwater stabilized? Meaning it's expected to remain in the existing area of contaminated groundwater, the delineation of the plume that you currently have as defined by monitoring locations. You can't make this determination unless you have monitoring wells that result in sampling and data that can confirm that it is in fact not growing in size. So if you're trying to make that determination, but you do not have monitoring wells, well, that's going to be problematic. One second here. Okay, so let's continue on to step four with, so this is assuming that you answered yes in step three. The next question is, does contaminated groundwater discharge into surface water bodies? Obviously, you need to have data to know that. So not enough data, then it's insufficient data. If your answer is no, then you'll drop down to step six. But let's say your answer is yes. If your answer is yes, you'll come down here. One second. Sorry, folks. I'm having a little issue with my browser here. Okay. So again, we did step four, looking at discharge to surface water bodies. We're looking at step five. Can the discharge of contaminated groundwater into surface water be shown to be currently acceptable? Meaning there's no unacceptable impacts or exposures happening. If you don't have enough data, insufficient data, if you can say no to step five, then you're going to say your contaminated groundwater migration is not under control. If you answer yes, we come down to step six, where we ask, will groundwater monitoring be collected to verify that the contaminated groundwater has in fact remained within that existing area? If the answer is no, you don't have sufficient monitoring, well, then your status is going to be not under control. However, if your answer is yes on step six, then you get to contaminated groundwater migration under control, which is where we would like all our sites to get to. All right. So here we're going to talk about other Superfund components. I know when you talk about environmental indicators, that can have impacts on other things. So where other Superfund components that we need to consider are things like five-year reviews, risk to human health, and of course, our site-wide ready for anticipated use. But all of these items are interrelated. So we're going to talk about each of them briefly. We'll start with five-year reviews. So during a five-year review, new information can be discovered during that process, right? That is likely to happen. Maybe you find a new exposure pathway or there's a new source of contamination that was recently discovered. Perhaps you have a situation with emerging contaminants, or there's uncertainty around groundwater plume migration. If any type of new information comes into play, this can affect whether the remedy is functioning as intended and if it is still, in fact, protective or not. So say you have a situation, there's an emerging contaminant at your site that's identified during the five-year review, and then you're like, well, there are exposures, there are complete exposure pathways that could be happening now. So we're going to say that this remedy is not protective. Okay, well, if your remedy is not protective because there are complete exposure pathways, that affects your environmental indicator for human risks, right? Human exposure. So that would change as well. And in a second, we have someone who's going to talk about how that affects our SWARU determinations. So just know, if there's a big change in your five-year review process, think about your environmental indicators. Also, when it comes to evaluating risk to human health, our EI for human exposures does not consider ecological risk. That's just something to be aware of. And also keep in mind that even if you don't have a remedy fully constructed and fully implemented, it still may be possible that your environmental indicators are under control at that site. And lastly, just because a site is deleted from the NPL does not mean that your EI determinations end with that deletion. In fact, the environmental indicator determinations must continue to happen even for those deleted NPL sites. So definitely keep that in mind. All right. Well, now I'm going to hand it over to Alexis so she can introduce herself and talk about SWARU.
All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Alexis Rourke-Reyes. I am at headquarters, also with Emmy and Boone, and I work in a different part of OzReady in the Superfund Redevelopment Program. And Superfund Redevelopment Program gets to do lots of fun work on kind of visualizing what reuse redevelopment might look like in a site, but we're also the data sponsor for the site-wide Ready for Anticipated Use, or SWARU, program performance measure. And so just, yeah, thanks for the invitation, Emmy and Boone, to just come and talk a little bit more about SWARU. It's very closely related, as has been said before, with some of these other measures. And so I think, you know, all of this is kind of in line with what we've been talking about, but wanted to just make sure that we addressed it, because it is something that site teams are kind of required to be looking at every year as they do their fiber reviews, as they do their EI kind of reviews as well. And so SWAR is a performance measure that we also look at it as tracking the program's progress in achieving key milestones. So this is something we think about as kind of on the path to site deletion. And what it means is when you achieve it, you see the kind of criteria here that have to be met in terms of being construction complete, having all institutional and other engineering controls in place. And then, of course, human exposure, having that indicator of the two kind of highest tier levels of that indicator, which are current human exposures controlled and protective remedy in place. I'll say, I know you've heard it, but HEPR, or long-term human health protection achieved. So that's that long, that's the dream that we're all living here, I guess, in Superfund. And so that's kind of the requirements. There's a little confusion sometimes between the human exposure indicator of human exposure under control and that being sufficient for SWARA, but it's not. We'll get into that in a little bit. But right now, amazingly, despite, you know, these really tough and criteria, we have about 950 sites or so that have achieved and maintained SWARA to date. So it's a good thing. Can you go to the next slide, please? Thank you. So again, getting into the human exposure status, I know you've been through several kind of flow charts now to kind of make that decision. I don't have any polls for you or flow charts, but we'll have to do that for next time. But we did just want to kind of reiterate here that to achieve this measure, it does come down back again to the human exposure status. So I'm so glad that everybody's had that good practice at making these determinations. And again, it's only these two that are in the white box at the bottom, HEPR or HHPA. So if it is HEUC, human exposure under control, that is still not sufficient for SWARU. So if that's what you end up making your determination or changing it to that, you will have to kind of do what, maybe go to the next slide, please. What we call a retraction of a SWARU site. And that is an just something that's part of the life cycle of the site, because, you know, as we're really lucky to be able to have these structures in place to monitor sites over the course of, you know, have an example here of a five-year review, things change on sites. And so we want to make sure that when your designation of human exposure changes, that you do go that extra step too, to go ahead and retract the SWARA designation if you need to. And so I won't get into the details of how you do that, but we do have resources in terms of a guidance coming up that will kind of outline that for you. But in the meantime, just to know that retraction is something that happens to a lot of sites, and it's something that can be reverted back again to achieving SWARU. And so it's just based on kind of the current, we do an ask sites to review kind of every year their SWARU status, particularly sites that have achieved and also sites that may be kind of on the brink of achieving it. Maybe they've reached some of the milestones like construction complete in particular, or reached have opportunity to change their human exposure indicator. That's another time to look at SWARU. So I'll go on to the next slide, please. And just wanted to Yeah, that one's perfect. Just wanted to highlight for folks, especially the EPA folks that we have here, a couple of resources. We know SWARU can be a complicated thing, as all of these performance measures, and we work really closely with Boone and others to make sure that the information that we're putting out is as clear as possible. And we do that in monthly calls. For every region has a coordinator for the SWARU measure, just like you do for environmental indicators. We also have office hours every month. And we are working on updating our guidance. It's going to be consistent with the human exposure indicator guidance that has been shared around. And you also have folks in your regions. So please feel free to reach out to them or to us directly with any questions about this. And I think with that, I'll give it back to Emmy. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that, Alexis. We appreciate it. So we are going to just go ahead and do a quick summary of what we've covered today in this webinar. So know that environmental indicators are designed to communicate to the public the tangible progress made in protecting human health and the environment. It's a way we keep ourselves as federal agencies responsible for the cleanups we're conducting. And also remember that a change in your EI status can impact other types of measures like SWARU that Alexis was just talking about, and also your five-year reviews and vice versa. With the human exposures under control, SWARU and our remedial action project completion, measures are reported to Congress. Those three are reported to Congress, even though our entire Superfund program tracks those six measures that we mentioned earlier. Also, make use of the tools and resources available when you're making your EI determinations or having conversations with your EPA RPM on what that EI determination means. I've been mentioning our 2022 updated guidance. Links to that are in your participant manual. Please check it out. There are templates in there that specifically discuss how you can write your justifications. And it also has some information on how to deal with emerging contaminants at your sites when it comes to making your EI determination. So very, very useful tool. And of course, you have Boone and myself who are happy to answer any questions. So we have a few minutes left together today. So I know some questions have come in. Jean, can we go ahead and answer some of those in our Q&A?
Absolutely. So I'll just remind the audience, you can submit your comments and questions for our speakers using the Q&A box if you haven't done so already. If you don't have any questions or comments, you can type that message into the Q&A. That does help us ensure that we're adequately using our time here. So again, type those questions or comments in or let us know if you don't have any. I'll start with some of the ones that came in earlier. And this first question gets to ecological exposures. One of the attendees asked, is there a companion guidance for ecological exposures? What is the guidance for determining if there are no human exposures, but ecological exposure pathways that are not under control?
Boo, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure, I can take that one. So we don't consider ecological risk in the human exposure evaluations, but there are ecological risk assessments that you could use for that information. I would reach out to your regional ecological risk assessor if they're not the same as the human health risk assessor. So hopefully that answers that question.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Our next question gets into where you were just talking about, Emmy, and that's, can a federal site lead challenge an EI determination that's been made by an RPM?
Oh, I'm sorry. So the question is how at a federal facility site, if the lead cleanup agency or that other federal agency disagrees with the EI determination, what can they do about that? Mm-hmm. That's
correct.
The question. Yep. Well, essentially the EI determination is made by EPA. Most federal facility agreements won't have discussion on coming to consensus on an EI determination. John, I'm not sure if you had other thoughts on this. Please jump in if you do. So if there's disagreement, I really encourage us to rely on those relationships we make at our federal facility sites at the site team level. You know, you have your representatives from EPA, the RPM, the other federal agency, their leads and contractors and state representatives are often there as well. Have those conversations to better understand, well, why EPA are you saying groundwater migration is not under control? We're doing such great things at our sites with pump and treat or what have you. I think really there's not a trigger that has an official way to dispute that determination, but you should always be able to go to your site team and have a conversation about what's happening when it comes to these EI determinations.
Oh, Alexis, were you responding? Just double checking. Nope. Okay. All right. Thank you. And then I do want to go back to you, Boone, because one of our attendees chimed in with a comment on your response regarding ecological considerations. And they note that we do need to consider eco for SWARU.
Yeah, thank you for that, friend. And I might give that one to Alexis since she deals with SWARU Alexis, I don't know if we've had discussions about ecological risk for SWARU recently.
No, not that I'm aware, especially I think with the guidance being revised coming up, that could be something that we could look into. But to my knowledge, it's really still based on the human risk as part of the assessment. If there's something specific that you want to follow up with, please feel free to send me an email. I can put my email in the chat as well.
Sure, that'd be great. We did have a clarifying statement that this has to be part of the decision document to be considered. So that I think she's just chiming in that there is a way to incorporate it or have it be part of the considerations for a site. Okay, we have some attendees who are looking for an example, and I'm not sure the extent to which they want you to give this example. It might be a hypothetical, but I think what they're asking for is how could this happen? So if you can walk them through a plausible example of how a situation like this could happen. One of the attendees was looking for an example where you have an offsite orphan plume that is adjacent to a federal facility site that has data gaps for CVOC pathways and a known plume migration.
Okay, so if you have your federal facility site, be it small or probably a large one, and you identify offsite plumes, there always comes the question as well, what was the source of that plume? Is it in fact from operations that happened at the site that led to this contamination migrating offsite, or is it a separate source? So I think that question has to be answered first before we look at how to address it or whether or not to consider it in your environmental indicators. If the contaminants are clearly similar to what you have on site, maybe there's that data gap is in the migration of the groundwater plume and more data needs to be collected before you can definitively say, yes, this is a part of the contamination from this site and needs to be addressed and considered for this site. But is there another source or a different group that might be responsible for that contamination? So I think that data gap has to be addressed first. I see John is nodding and said, we have this happen a lot. John, did you want to add anything?
Now, the only thing I'll add is, you know, sometimes in instances like that, we'll notify the folks in the site assessment branch and they can go and see if there's any other sites that may be in the surrounding area where we could track something like that down. But the determination itself that we're making would be specific to this site.
Right. Thank you, John. I hope that answered your question.
We have another question that came in. If or when an RSL changes, does an EI get revised retroactively?
So, Boone, I don't know if you want to talk about retroactive changes. Remember, EI determinations are made every year and can be made at any time during that year. Boone, do you want to elaborate?
Yeah, that's correct. At minimum, they need to be reevaluated once per year. Even if during that evaluation there isn't any update to be made, it at least needs to get that that analysis once a year. But as Emmy said, if there are any rule changes that happen, if there's any new information that needs to be taken into consideration at any point that may impact the EI evaluations, that is an appropriate time to reevaluate and potentially change the designation. So remember, the key is the current status. And so we want to make these changes. The guidance says within 10 days of new information, as the regions can do in SEMS.
All right. We also have some attendees who are asking questions about PFAS and what to do.
So, I'm not surprised that there are questions about PFAS, especially at our federal facilities.
Yes, I feel as though it comes up everyone on the session. Someone has a question. But so this first question is just, if PFAS is named a CERCLA hazardous substance, does it then follow that no CERCLA site will ever have an HEPR designation in the near term?
That is a very heavy question. But I would say we can't assume that all CERCLA sites have PFAS, because not all CERCLA sites do. For those sites that do have PFAS contamination, being able to get sufficient data to answer at what concentration that contamination is at and the exposure pathways that are present is very important. So I understand it feels like if PFAS became a CERCLA hazardous substance that we would never have protective remedies in place. But I think it's very site specific that we have to look at the answer to that. And it may or may not, depending on the concentrations you have, mean that there is unacceptable risk to humans from that site. So it's a very heavy question. We're all waiting with bated breath to see what will happen with the rulemaking for those specific PFOS, PFOA substances that have RSLs. And so we will wait and see as that process moves forward.
And I'll just add to that real quick. Once that rule does get through the public comment period and is finalized, we'll update the guidance accordingly with more information. Right now, we should still evaluate it as a pollutant or contaminant until that rulemaking is done.
Right. And I guess I'll just mention, remember, we look at cumulative risk, not risk from a single contaminant. So that also has to be considered. You may have contamination from other known contaminants that obviously present a risk, an acceptable risk, and for which there are complete exposure pathways. So definitely something, we can't just single out the one. We have to look at this site-wide measure on a site-wide basis.
Okay. All right. One more question related to PFAS. In this situation, the attendee noted that at one of their sites, a protectiveness deferred determination was made due to the presence of PFAS. So, for example, there was insufficient data to determine protectiveness. They wonder, how do these types of performance measures relate to five-year review protectiveness statements?
I can start that one off. So that's a very good question. The updated guidance actually has a section dealing with this exact question. So kind of explaining the difference between a human exposure evaluation and a five-year review protectiveness statement. What we say is that they're not synonymous. They don't always have to completely correlate, but often five-year review protectiveness determinations are a great source of information for updating EIs, especially sites that are under control. But when we do those five-year reviews, it's a great time to reevaluate for new information. So new contaminants, new pathways. In the situation that you cited in the Q&A, a five-year review protectiveness deferred determination is often a very good reason to reevaluate a site as HEID.
All right. I don't see any other questions in the queue at this time, although I did see a number of compliments and thank yous from our live audience. So, Emmy, I'll turn it back to you all to provide your final thoughts here before we close things out for the day.
Sure. So, again, we have our contact information up on screen now. If you'd like to jot that down with any follow-up questions, we are happy to help. Just know if it is very site-specific, we're likely going to want your EPA RPM to come into the conversation. But if you have questions on the guidance or on policy or typical trends that we see, we are very happy to answer those questions for you. So please feel free to reach out.
All right, excellent. And Emmy, if it's okay with you, I'm going to go ahead and take over and I'll walk the audience through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. So with that, I'm going to take over the screen share and I will walk everyone through those final reminders. So if you joined us late, I did want to remind everyone that today's session is part of that ongoing Federal Facilities Academy. There are 11 webinars that are open to the public, which we're hosting through the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org. So we will carry on with our next session in November, where we're going to look at coordinating with tribes at federal facilities. So hopefully you all be able to join us for the next one in the ongoing series. Now, I will remind you all that you can visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN website at cluin.org. And if you aren't already subscribed, I strongly encourage that you sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month. And we highlight various resources on cleaning up and characterizing hazardous waste sites, like today's webinar. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material, those are available on the seminar homepage. So that's shown in red on this slide. It's the same URL we sent you when you registered. It's the same URL I put out in our reminder emails. It's the same email you would have gotten when you got a confirmation message and then checked in for today's session. It looks something like this sample webpage, and it will be available from today forward. So if you are looking for copies of the materials along with a reference handout that has a collection of related URLs, I'll encourage you to visit this URL. You can bookmark it and go back to it later on or share it with your friends. Just note that we have sections sort of broken up in these gray boxes along the page. So you may need to scroll up and down or use the plus and minus buttons to collapse or expand various sections to find the content. For this particular session, the slides have been organized along with very detailed supplemental notes as something called the participant manual. So when you go to the slide section, you'll see a file that's actually labeled the participant manual, but I encourage you to download it because it does have a lot of great useful references. Now, for those of you who are looking to document your attendance or participation in our session today, you can receive a participation certificate, just like the one shown on the slide, after you fill out the feedback form for today's session. So on that very same URL that I showed in red on the slide, there will be a section for the feedback form. If you scroll down to that, fill out the form and make sure that you check the box certifying you were here for the entire live delivery or replayed the entire recording. As soon as you fill out the form and submit your feedback, you will then have access to a participation certificate. You can download it from the confirmation screen. I'll also email you a copy, but those can sometimes get caught up in junk filters. So I encourage you to download it when you see that confirmation message rather than relying upon the email. If you joined with a number of people in one room, in a conference room, through a viewing party, remember each person in that room can fill out the feedback form whether they registered on their own. So I encourage you, if you were the one who did register, please share the URL to the seminar homepage to everyone who joined you at your location so they can fill out that feedback form on their own and get their own certificate for their own records. Today's session was recorded just like the others in the series. And if you missed it, here it is for a third time, again, shown in red. That's the URL for today's session. So if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version right now, you can go to that URL or in the archived version right now. There'll be a button somewhere above my head in the upper right corner on the online recorded version where you can click and jump right to that feedback form. If it's not there though, just copy and paste in this URL into your browser and share your thoughts in the feedback form and check the box certifying you replayed the whole recorded version, and then you can still get one of those certificates based off of your replay. Usually takes us about 1 week to get the archive up, so please keep an eye on your inbox in the next week, and I'll let you know when that's available. So with that, I want to thank the nearly 170 people who joined us for today's live broadcast, along with our speakers who came together from EPA's various cleanup programs here to cover today's session. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that I will see you or hear from you on a future internet seminar. With that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.